everyone, and welcome to this audio conference training for rural grantees of the Office on Violence Against Women. My name is Liz Carlson, and I'll be the host for today's call. This is the first of a two-part series on developing a shared philosophical approach, a core element of a coordinated community response to battering. The topic for discussion today is Theory Matters, Linking Safety Theory and Interventions with Ellen Pence, the executive director here at Praxis. Hi, Ellen, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you.
Before Ellen gets started, I'd like to just briefly explain a couple of logistics about how these calls work. First of all, there's just been a little bit of a change of plan. All of you received the PowerPoint and three resources from me yesterday, I believe, for today's call. One of those resources is a transcript, and we're going to save that for our training tomorrow. So I'll resend it to you, but that will be a part of tomorrow's training, so you don't need to worry about that for today. Stephanie, our operator, is going to be on the line for the whole call today, and she's going to keep the lines muted so that you don't have to worry about that individually. When Ellen is ready for questions or comments, Stephanie will let all of you know how to get into the question queue at that time. That's all that I have for logistics right now. So welcome, Ellen, and if you would, why don't you go ahead and get us started with our training.
Okay, thanks a lot, Liz, and welcome everyone to this two-part series on Theory Matters, and we're going to be talking both today and tomorrow. Is it tomorrow, Liz?
It is tomorrow.
Yeah, today and tomorrow.
Two.
Okay,
yep.
2 days in a row.
Yep.
I was just telling Liz that I wish I could switch the days around now, because now I want to talk about tomorrow's topic first. But so I'm going to merge these 2 days, because I'm assuming that almost everybody's going to be at both. But what I wanted to talk about today is just this definition of domestic violence, and then tomorrow we'll talk a little bit about, domestic violence is a huge term. I mean, it means basically any time one adult in a relationship somehow hits, pushes, shoves, does some kind of illegal act of violence against another, and most acts of violence are illegal except self-defense. So if I were to throw a bag of potato chips at my partner, it would be domestic violence. And then stalking someone and battering someone and you know, making someone's life miserable is domestic violence. So it really encompasses a huge broad range of behaviors that go on in intimate relationships. And not surprising to probably most of you on the phone, more than half of the people in the United States use some kind of violence at one time or another against a partner, men and women. People push their partners, they slap their partners, they throw things at their partners, half the people on this phone at some time or another have used some kind of violence against a partner. And all that domestic violence is lumped together in one great big huge category. And under the law, it's all one great big huge category. Now, I think most of us know that what everybody meant to deal with when we started this whole social movement to confront wife beating, really, battering, was what we were trying to get after was battering. And battering is a different thing than domestic violence. It's a form of domestic violence, and it's the one that this social movement organized to stop, which is the sustained, ongoing use of coercion, intimidation, and violence by one partner against another that is intended to control them. It's intended to create a relationship, really, of dominance. And so battering is one thing. It's one part of domestic violence. And tomorrow we're going to talk about the different forms of domestic violence and why it's important to distinguish them, and then why people get it wrong so often when they do start distinguishing them and put people in the wrong category of domestic violence. But right now I want to talk about the different theories that people have about domestic violence. And I want to start out by telling a little story about a guy that was, years ago I did batterers groups, and this guy Jason was in my group, and I want to kind of tell his story. And then you're going to actually get a chance to vote. So get ready when I tell you to. You get to, if you're going to vote yes, you get to push the number one on your phone. But first I want to tell you the story of this guy, and then you're going to decide what to do with him. And Jason was a guy that had come into my group. He was, I think, about maybe 35, 36 years old. He had been married for 13 years to his wife, and they had two children. when they met, she was pregnant, and that guy kind of disappeared from her life. So when she had that baby, 2 years later, he adopted that baby, and her son's name was Brad. And so anyways, Jason battered her for probably about 9 years of their marriage, and he also was very abusive towards his first partner. He got arrested maybe 6 times during the course of their marriage. He had dislocated her shoulder once. He had cracked a bone in her elbow once. He had hit her many times, kicked her, slugged her in the face. You know, so it was a lot of violence, and it was fairly harsh violence. It wasn't a pusher, shover, grabber type. He was more than that. And the last time that he assaulted her, there were people present. The police showed up. The people present were very willing to testify, and so he finally got convicted of assaulting her, and he pled guilty. He got a 90-day sentence for his first misdemeanor assault. He was ordered to a chemical dependency program because he was had been drinking very heavily for the last 6 years. And then he was ordered after the chemical dependency program to go to a 27-week batterers program. And that was the program that I was working in, and he got sent to my group. So anyways, he goes through his chemical dependency thing, and he comes into my group. And he was kind of a good group member because he talked a lot about his feelings and initiated a lot of conversations. But he was absolutely convinced his problem was alcohol. And he would always be saying, you know, I drank and I did this and I drank. And I'd say to him, no, you know, Jason, you're also a batterer. And he loved his counselor. Her name was Nancy Oaken. And he would always be bringing up, Nancy says, Nancy says, Nancy says. And I was so sick of hearing about Nancy. One day I finally called her up and I said, Nancy, I've got, you know, so-and-so in my group. And he just adores you. He thinks that you, you know, walk on water and stuff. So I'm wondering if you could call him up and tell him he's a batterer and an alcoholic, because I'm having a hard time getting through to him that alcohol wasn't his only problem. And she said, oh, sure. So she calls him and has a little chit-chat with him. And the next day he comes in and says, Nancy says, I'm a wife beater. And he basically kind of falls into line after that and really starts thinking about and talking about his use of violence towards his partner. And he just became like, oh my God, the angel group member, because he was very self-reflective in a lot of ways. And you know, if I would bring up the thing about in what different ways do people try to embarrass their wives, he would raise his hand right away and say, you know what I used to do to my wife, and give examples of it and things like that. So he was very much into examining his behavior and committed, I think, to change it. He appeared to be. So one day he comes home. It's a Friday night, not only was he drinking and battering her, but he also had gotten into gambling, which he also quit at this time. But they had gone into bankruptcy because of his gambling. So there was a court date that was set that he had missed. And it was a court date that you do as a pre-thing to going bankrupt in Minnesota that allows you to not have all your creditors come and take your TV sets and take things out of your house. You pay a certain fee down, and you do this little, you have this little hearing, and then the judge kind of says to the creditors, okay, if you all agree on taking this much money, then people can't be going over and taking their stuff back. So he had missed that court date, and he had then really lost the opportunity to have this kind of a, not only a hearing, but have this kind of protection. And the lawyer had called up and talked to his wife and said, well, why didn't he show up? And she said, I don't know. I didn't even know about the hearing. So when he came home that night, the minute he walked in the door, she was mad at him. And she said, do you want to tell me why you didn't go to that hearing today? And he went, I just couldn't go. And she said, what do you mean you just couldn't go? And he said, I'm so humiliated by this, I couldn't go. Oh, you just couldn't go. That's your excuse? And he said, yeah, I just can't even tell you the stress that it's caused me. Oh, you're stressed out. Is that what you're trying to say? And so then she lights into him, you know, you're stressed out. You can't take it. You're emotionally hurt. you know, I am sick of your feelings. I am sick of you. I am sick of your irresponsibility. You should have been there. Now, you're not going to be here when the creditors show up, are you? You're going to be gone having feelings about it. And so she's just on him and on him and on him, and he's saying, I know I should have gone. I know it was irresponsible. Oh, is that what you're going to say now? I was irresponsible, and that just takes care of it? What, are you going to go to a irresponsibility group next? And he just kind of looked at her and said, you know, this conversation is not going well. I think we should stop. And she says, oh, you think we should stop. You think you shouldn't go to the hearing. You think it was okay to get us into this debt. You think we should stop talking about it now. And he said, well, I'm going to stop talking about it now. And he grabbed his jacket and he went to go out the door. And he says, I'm just leaving for a while. I'll be back. And she stood in front of the door and she said, fine, you go. You go off and maybe why don't you call one of your little buddies in your little batterers group and do a little check-in with him. Why don't you take your little time out? But I will be here, home, thanking God every day that our son Brad isn't yours, that he won't have the same screwed-up genes you have. So go ahead and go. And he just looked at her, and he grabbed her by both arms, and he threw her up against the wall, and he pulled his fist back, and he just looked at her, and he said, sometimes I hate you, and out the door he went. And he was gone for like a couple hours. He called back, and he said, I'm sorry. I had no right to grab you. I had no right to push you like that. And he said, I'm sorry. I won't come home tonight if you don't want me to. And she said, no, I was just so mad. I just said everything I could think of to hurt you. She said, I want you to come home. So he comes home. And then that next Monday, he shows up in his men's group and tells this whole story. So this is where you all come in. You are going to vote on what to do with Jason now. And these are going to be your options. I'll give you your options, and then I want you to press the number one when I tell you to, if you are going to take that option. And then I'll give you another choice to not take that option, and those of you who aren't going to take it, press the number one. So everybody get ready, and if there's more than one of you in your room, you're going to have to raise your hands and vote as a group, okay? So somebody get ready to press the number one at your phone. My first question is, you're me, you're the group leader. I'm going to tell you all your choices so you can think these through. First of all, I'm going to ask you, are you going to call the probation officer or not and report it? Then if you do report it, the probation officer is going to ask you what to do. So I'm going to ask you, are you going to recommend that Jason get some jail time? And if you're going to give him jail time, I'm going to ask you, are you going to give him a short amount of jail time or a lot of jail time? Are you going to give him 5 days or are you going to give him 90 days? The most you can give him is 90. Then I'm going to ask you if instead of jail time, you might give him community service instead. And then I'm going to ask you if you wouldn't give any kind of punishment like that. And then I'm going to ask you if you would have him start the group over. I'm going to ask you if you would try to get those two to go to counseling together, have him stay in his group, but at the same time, she does not want him to go to jail. She does not want, she feels like she, you know, that she said all these hurtful things to him, and she feels quite guilty about the whole thing, and she is saying that he's doing really good in his group and he's making huge progress, and she thinks, she just does not want him to go to jail for doing this. And so are you going to convince her to go with him to couples counseling and let him stay in his group at the same time? The next choice you're going to have is, are you going to set up counseling for her, not him and her together, but just for her, to help her deal with her own anger issues and to help her deal with his timeouts? And then the last choice is, are you going to basically let the group decide, have him tell the story to the group and let the group decide what to do? So here's your choices, and now I'm going to take you through a voting process, and get ready now. I don't want any non-voters there. So Stephanie, let me ask you, how many people are on the phone?
Currently there are 51 locations.
Okay, so now it's 51 locations, so I want 51 votes here, all right, everyone? And this better equal out to 51, or I don't know what I'm going to do. But the first thing is, press 1 if your location is going to call the probation officer and report that he's violated his probation. Press 1 now. So, Stephanie, can you tell me how many ones we got?
21.
Okay. So press 1 now if you're not going to call the probation officer. How'd we do on that one, Stephanie?
19.
Okay, that's 11 people didn't vote, so 11 people can't make up their minds. You'll never be judges. Okay, next question is, how many of you are going to recommend to the probation officer that he get a small jail sentence? Press 1 if you're going to give him a small jail sentence. Stephanie, how many votes did we get?
7.
Now tell me if you're going to give him a lot of jail time. Like 90 days or 70 days or something like that. How many of those votes did we get, Stephanie?
8.
And how many are you going to give him no jail time at all? And all you non-voters get in there, because you're obviously not giving him jail time here, so I want to get... I'm hoping I'm going to get 35 votes on this. No jail time. How many of those did we get, Stephanie?
26.
Okay, well, I'm still getting those same 9 that aren't voting. Okay, next, how many are you going to give them community service? Have them do community service rather than jail time. Stephanie, how many of those?
10.
10, okay. How many of you are going to have him start his group over? Stephanie?
15.
How many of you are going to have... get her and him to go to counseling together and at the same time let him stay in his batterers group? Stephanie?
6.
6. How many of you are going to set up counseling for her separate from him to figure out how to deal with her own anger and to figure out how to deal with his timeouts? Stephanie?
11.
Okay. And how many of you are going to just throw this out to the group and let the group decide what his consequence will be?
10.
10. Okay, your last vote is, how many of you think some people voted really stupid? And you just think you would never vote that way on this. Stephanie?
16.
16, okay, very good, thank you. All right, Stephanie, that's the end of our polling, okay? Okay, so the reason I wanted you to do that was to show the differences in how all of us on the phone are thinking about this. Some would have them go to jail, some would have them do, it's split about 50-50 of how many people would give a little bit of jail time, how many people would give a lot of jail time. Most people wouldn't give jail time. It's split all over the map on what kind of changes you would make in a counseling program. Very few, if you only 6 out of the 40 people voting would have them go to group together. And some of you, quite a few of you did set up counseling for her. So about 17 of you would have her go to some kind of counseling after this incident. 17 out of 40 people voting, around 40 people were voting. So let's just, all of those things indicate a philosophy or a theory or a way that you're thinking about this, and we don't all think about it the same. Now, we, those of us on the phone, are mostly domestic violence advocates. There's people on the phone that are working with advocacy programs, law enforcement people, et cetera. But mostly the people that are on this phone are from the domestic violence field, and we think somewhat alike. So if you were to kind of take this group that's on the phone and expand that to the whole community that intervenes in these cases, you'd have a lot more disagreement. And we had a significant amount of disagreement amongst ourselves of these things. So I want to talk a little bit about that. Those disagreements about this come from our theories about where the violence comes from, but also what would best interrupt or stop the violence. So I want to talk a little bit about this word theory, because that's what we're talking about today, is our theories, our concepts, our assumptions about what's going on. And theories, if I can just give the kind of the clearest little example, a theory is like pointing a finger at something. It's saying, here, look at this. A theory takes, it's an explanation for why something's going on that kind of points a finger at a certain thing that's driving a certain phenomena for happening. So the theories of domestic violence are different people voted differently on the phone because you had different theories about what was causing that violence. Now, some of you actually can hold contradictory theories. I'm going to go through five theories, and you're going to say, oh, I agree with that one, but you will have voted actually out of a different one. So you can actually hold two different theories about the same thing, and I'll explain a little bit why that goes on with us later. But I wanted to say that tomorrow we're going to talk about different types of domestic violence. We're going to talk about battering, which is this kind of ongoing kind of method of controlling and using intimidation towards a person. We're going to talk about resistive violence, which is people who fight back against battering, and not just in self-defense, but both legal and illegal ways. And then there's a whole bunch of other domestic violence that occurs that's not battering, that is, you know, it comes from mental illness, it comes from alcoholism, it comes from different sources, but it's not necessarily an ongoing pattern of abuse. Now, the case that I described to you is a case of battering. This guy has, for many, many years, battered her, and now he's in a program, and he's been stopped, in a way, by an arrest, by an intervention by the state, and he's working on giving this whole thing up, and something's come up. A behavior of hers that was quite undesirable, and he used violence again. So we're going to say that his violence is a continuation of his battering, even though all of us, I think almost all of us on the phone would agree that her behavior towards him was far less than desirable, was not spiritually evolved, it was not nice, it was unkind, it was mean, it was even cruel on some emotional sense. So she did something to him that was very, very hurtful, and he used violence back at her. And we're going to connect that violence back to the fact that he has been using violence against her for many, many years. So in a sense, he's stopping his violence, but he hasn't stopped it completely because he used it again in a situation that was hurtful to him. So I want to talk about these theories of battering and kind of show how they get meshed up when you look at a case like his. The first theory of battering is that battering or in many of these kinds of domestic violence, whether it's battering or whether it's couples violence that isn't kind of so much battering, there's a notion that this violence comes from a dysfunction in the relationship, that two people get together and, you know, there's just, they just don't communicate well. They don't share. They don't play nice together. They just bump up against each other in many different ways. And because neither one has really good communication skills, or they don't have good relationship skills, it turns into almost a dysfunctional relationship where a lot of little things become high conflict kind of situations that don't need to be, and that it leads to violence. That is probably the most commonly held theory within the criminal justice system, that this kind of violence is two people that don't know how to do relationships. Another theory of domestic violence that is very commonly held is that this kind of violence is a learned response to stress and anger. Lenore Walker actually came up with this second theory, and she came up with it in response to this notion that it was a dysfunction in the relationship, because she talked to so many, particularly women who were being battered, who were saying, I was trying to accommodate him. I was trying to do this, but there was nothing I could say or do that day and not get hit. It was all about what he was going through, not what I was going through and not what we were going through. And so Lenore Walker started to look at all these situations where the guy would come home and he's just wound up tight, and he picks a fight with her so he can hit her. And she then shifted off of this notion of it was something that was going on in the relationship to something that was going on with him. And what she pinpointed, again, a theory points to something, is Walker's theory was that domestic violence, is a learned response to stress and anger. So when he had too much stress building up in him or anger building up in him and he didn't have healthy ways of letting that go, it would result in him abusing her. And then Lenore Walker also came up with, as a part of that theory, what she called the three-phase cycle of battering. The tension-building phase, when tension builds up with him, anger builds up with him. The explosion phase, in which he strikes out, and that can happen in 2 seconds or over a two-day period, or it can be very extended kind of form of intimidation and violence. And then the respite phase, which other people coined as the honeymoon phase. The respite phase is when he starts to say, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that, and that's not what I don't want to hurt you, I don't want to do these kind of things, and he starts to apologize. People also call it the hearts and flowers stage or whatever. And so now he's trying to get, he realizes that what he's done is kind of alienated her, pushed her away, and he's trying to bring her back by his apologies and trying to make up to her for it. That theory, the second theory, really kind of displaced the relationship theory in many ways and became a very, very commonly held theory in the legal system. And it's why you ended up having all these anger management groups that started up all over the country. We're going to send him to anger management. He's got an anger control problem, a stress problem. The third theory, which is getting a lot of new attention these days, this is kind of a coming back theory, and that is that battering is an individual pathology, that the person has some kind of, from their childhood, some kind of a psychological problem, and that can be anything from, an inability to express anger properly to abandonment kinds of issues, fundamental kind of insecurity issues, having experienced a lot of violence as a child, having what some people are talking about is kind of a notion of brain trauma, where certain kinds of brain development happened during the formative years when a child was experiencing and seeing a lot of violence, that it created brain patterns, etc., that means that people are going to go to that as a solution as they get older. Post-traumatic stress syndrome is another psychological kind of theory, that when this child or this person experienced trauma as a child and violence as a child, then certain things kick that in, and that's how they then react. People coming home from war, people coming home out of camps, places where there was extreme trauma and violence, that they would react then with violence later in life. So you have a lot of psychological explanations for an individual person battering a person. And all of those are lumped together they oftentimes have different psychological kind of profiles to them, but together they all are a notion of individual pathology. Another whole group or way of explaining all of this violence is what people who really have more of a spiritual or religious kind of look at life is that people are on a path in life, and if they're right with the universe, whether you kind of come from a spiritual approach or a more religious one, if you're right with God or you're right with your religion, like for example, if you're a Christian and if you're on a path of Christianity and you're right with Jesus, then you're not going to be doing things like beating up your wife. When you get off that path, then you're on to a path that's going to mean sin. it's going to need, you know, it's going to be a path away from the good path. And so people who are might not have such a kind of a religious notion of it, they have a spiritual notion of it. Native American people have the notion of being on, you know, a good path, and people who get off the path, who end up, you know, alienated from understanding the connectedness of all things to each other. So if you come from a religion that believes that all things are connected, then if you hit your wife, you're actually hitting yourself. You're actually connected to this person. So there's that whole other realm of explanation of things, of that it's a spiritual alienation or et cetera. And then the last theory, the one that the Battered Women's Movement basically has promoted, even though many people in the Battered Women's Movement hold these other theories also, but the last theory that is the one that people recognize as the one that's kind of exemplified in the power and control wheel, which is that this battering is a expression of power in a relationship, and it's an expression of control, and that the violence is part of it. It's not separate from, but it's part of a whole system of behaviors of isolation, of intimidation, of you know, using children, using money to control the other person, and it's an effort to dominate in a relationship, and then use violence as the mechanism to kind of strengthen all these other tactics. So those are the basic theories that describe and try to define battering. Now, in some ways, who cares? Who cares which one of these is right? Battering is battering. Somebody's clocking somebody else. Somebody's, you know, making someone's life miserable. We should stop them, and we should say, you don't get to do this, regardless of what your motivation is or what the source is in your head. You just don't get to do this. And so why do we have to kind of pick apart all these theories? Well, the reason that I think it's important to recognize different theories is that when people hold these theories, they respond, they intervene out of these theories. And they intervene in ways that reflect their theory. Might not reflect what's actually going on, but it reflects their theory about what's going on. So let's say that you are a judge, and you think, you know, these two just cannot get along. They have a dysfunctional relationship. And so if you see it that way, then when those two split up, you don't think, you think, okay, finally, they got away from each other. They're going to quit torturing each other. If you hold the theory that it's about power and control, when those two split up, you think, uh-oh, now things could get worse, because she's just walked out of here on him. If she's the one that left the relationship, now if he leaves the relationship and says, you know what, I'm done with you, I'm off to another woman, I'm out of here, that might not really be so dangerous to that woman. It might be dangerous to the next woman, but it's not dangerous to the woman that's getting left. But if she walks out of him, and your theory is that it's control and it's battering, then you are going to see that now she's in more danger. But if you see it as a relationship dysfunction and they split up, you're not going to see that she's in more danger. So the theory that you have is important because it alerts you it kind of directs your intervention, but it also alerts you to what makes you think something is or is not dangerous. So let me say a few things about these different theories. I hold the last theory, which is that battering, not all forms of domestic violence, and tomorrow we're going to talk about domestic violence that isn't battering, but when someone is using this ongoing use of violence, somebody like the guy that I told you about, Jason, that batterers and battering is a part of an ongoing concerted effort to control the other person. And it has with it always a notion of entitlement, that I'm entitled to somehow control you. And within that theory, then, resistance by the person who's being controlled will typically be punished, and punished harshly. So if she starts to fight back, if she starts to call in extra help, if she starts to say, I'm going to move out for a while until you can do this, all those things can actually cause more violence than less, because it means that he's got to, if he wants to stay in control of that relationship, he's got to bring her back under his control. And so when you have this notion of the power and control and the dominance theory, you're always looking at it as him over her and dominating her. And you're always looking at power as being the main thing that the violence produces. It produces an excess of power for him and not enough power for her. And so it also produces the inability for her to speak freely. And this is why I think this is important. If it's simply a relationship dysfunction, then she can go in the courtroom and say, Your Honor, the guy's a jerk. I don't like him. If it's about power and control, then she's going to go into the court and say, No, Your Honor, the police lied. That's not what I told him happened, because she's in a position of having to protect him. The theory of dominance shows a relationship of a dominator and a dominated. And that relationship is what the criminal justice system is, as this case grinds on in that criminal justice system, the frustration with the criminal justice system is not about the crime. It's not even about the offender. It's about the relationship of dependence that the victim has on the offender, the relationship of protection, the relationship of secrecy, the inability to speak freely. And what they will turn around and say that she's in denial, or maybe use words like she's a reluctant witness or she's a recanter. But if you hold the theory of power and control, you see that the purpose of violence is to control a person. And when outsiders step in to intervene in that, the batterer uses not all that control that they have worked on for these years to shield himself from the outside intervener. Now, one of the things about this theory that I'm saying of power and control is that it's always shaped in a triangle. Okay, so you've got power at the top of that triangle, and it's the same shape of power in other aspects of social life. So the reason I want to bring this up is that it's a gender issue in this culture and in most cultures around the world, that men hold control in their personal relationships with women, in their private lives, in the family life, by virtue of the fact that they live in societies that say that men should be in control of the political, of the social, and that in the private sphere, women have power there, but their power is still subservient to men. And so the individual batterer, it does not, like, you know, when I used to do batters groups, we created this curriculum for doing batters groups in Duluth, and there wasn't any other curriculum out there anywhere. I mean, people were doing anger management stuff, or they were doing this and that, and we created this power and control wheel, and then we went and interviewed all these women, like 220 women in different women's groups, and we said, okay, describe what's going on, and from those descriptions, we came up with this power and control wheel. And women were saying, well, it's not just him hitting, it's not just the physical and sexual abuse, it's all that other stuff of using the kids and the money and the isolation. You can't see your mother, you can't see your sister, you can't get a job, and all those kind of things that he was doing. So we would go and listen to all these stories of women, and then we made skits out of some of the stories, and we'd show women the skits, and we'd have them vote on the most popular skit, the skit that everybody could kind of relate to. And then we filmed all those. And we took those films and went into the men's groups, and we said, we'd show this skit, and we'd say, what is this guy doing? And the men would say, oh, well, he's intimidating, or he's, you know, kind of emotionally abusing her. And then we'd analyze that with the men, and we'd talk about, well, why is he doing this? And we would basically be showing him the kind of things that he was doing and then analyzing those with him and then talking about how he was doing some of those in his relationship. So we created this whole curriculum by doing this little power and control wheel and all these little skits out of it. And this curriculum just kind of took off. Everybody, you know, said, oh, what are we going to do with these batteries? And this looked good because it wasn't blaming women and it had the power and control wheel. So lots and lots of people used this curriculum. And because of that, we started ending up going out and training people on how to do it. And so I ended up in New Zealand and Australia and Ireland and England training people on this curriculum. And I'd always say, well, do you have men's groups now? And they'd say yes. And I'd say, okay, well, I'll just come there and I'll do a couple of groups for you and show you how to use it. So I started doing groups in New Zealand and Australia and Ireland, and these men would say, except they had accents and they had little ways of saying it, they said the exact same thing the men in my group back in Duluth were saying. I mean, like almost word for word. And I thought, well, is there some kind of international brochure that goes out and tells everybody what to say? But, you know, it's that these tactics of domination are not just particular to this individual man. It's nothing about his personal kind of like, oh, I'm going to learn to be a batterer. I want to grow up and be a wife beater. You know, he's socialized into it in these social kinds of conditions and ways of men talking about things that are universal across societies in which in societies that are patriarchal. And so you would go every place you'd go, and even when I started going to countries that it wasn't even English speaking and I had interpreters there, the men were saying the same thing to me. So I'm kind of going away going, oh my gosh, this is kind of universal about the same concepts of gender domination would be the same things if you went around and went to Germany or went to New Zealand or went to Australia and you worked with racists that were somehow caught by the law and put in some kind of an anti-racist group. They would be saying racism has the same kinds of notions and assumptions and ways of talking about the person that you're being racist towards. So this whole idea of gender and gender domination and gender violence, and that became more and more and more clear, at least to me, as I started doing groups with men around the, out both within the United States and outside the United States. And what also became more clear was the parallels between domination by gender, domination by race, domination by sexual preference, all those things. When you get a group, that's why that triangle becomes so important to me. When you've got somebody at the top of that triangle, one of the characteristics of that triangle is that people who are at the top of it, they objectify those that are at the bottom. They think people who are at the bottom of that are less than them, so they've got a notion of superiority, but they also objectify them. They make them into the other. And so you have to kind of look at these, if you look at gender violence and you look at the power and control wheel and you look at the notion of dominance, it works the same and it works in parallel ways, whether you're talking about race or gender, et cetera, et cetera. So for me it became, when I was trying to understand why is this guy saying something this weird, you know, I would start to think of myself as a white person. I'm white, and I'd start to think, you know, I have some of these same kind of thoughts that he has. So it started me really realizing my own consciousness around race and my consciousness, like I would think about, he would say something, I'd think about, you know, I've had those same kind of thoughts, but they're racial thoughts or the anti-Semitic thoughts. I don't necessarily act on them quite as much as these guys do. I'm more of a racist thinker than I am a doer, but I think, on a whole continuum, you can see that he's struggling with the same kind of notions of superiority and his lack of recognition of it. Most of the men in my groups sincerely felt victimized by the women they were battering. But at the same time, I listen to white people all the time who feel victimized by people of color. What's with this affirmative action stuff now? Now what are they going to want? What's the next thing? And when white people talk that way, it's exactly the way batterers talk. I remember this guy in my group saying, you know, I thought your program was pretty good because I came here and I started seeing some stuff. And, you know, my wife said to me, if you ever hit me again, I'm leaving you. So I have not hit her. I haven't touched her. I've not done any, I've not yelled at her, screamed at her, called her name since I've been in this group. Now, the other night, she goes off to her women's group. She comes home. You know what she says to me? She wants respect. Now, where is this going to all end, huh? It just keeps going and going and going. And so I'm just thinking, oh, my God, it's just like these white people who are kind of complaining, like, oh, now they're going off and they want their own meetings and things like that. So I think the easiest way for me to understand what goes on in a guy's head that batters is to understand how as a white person, how white people think and how we get ourselves caught up in being victims and caught up in, yeah, but look what they did, yeah, but look at this, and always wanting to point that finger, point it away from being very self-reflective. So I'm going through all of this. I'm going to open it up for questions now for a little bit, but I'm kind of going through all this because I want people to understand that this notion of power and control is not just a simple notion of this individual guy wants power and control, but this guy lives in a society let me put it this way. I realized after a while that men came preconditioned into my group, and they even came into their marriage, into their relationship with women, already thinking in certain ways, and women came in preconditioned into those groups because they grew up in societies that talked about, that kind of gave him this notion of entitlement. You know, when I think about entitlement, again, for me as a white person, when I have traveled around the world, I'll get off of a plane in a country that's really quite poor, and the first thing I'll look around and say, where's the hotel with the air conditioning? That's where I'm staying. This notion of entitlement that no matter where I go, I get to have air conditioning, I get to have comforts, I get to have a car. I don't want to take one of these rickety old trucks that's just barely, that's barely put together. I go into a third world poor country and I expect these first world comforts as if I'm entitled to them. And that's kind of this, you're not even conscious so much of it when you do it, except that later I started to be able to see how people saw somebody like me. And this whole notion of, oh, this American coming here, and they're so arrogant, and they're so this, and they're so that. And I think, yeah, aren't they, though? But then I realize it's me they're talking about. And so for some of these guys that were in my group, they really didn't see their entitlement. I mean, they'd raise their hand in my group, and they'd say, Ellen, what do you do if you live with a woman who just doesn't understand? I explained to my wife 5 different ways the same point, and she doesn't get it. And I'd say, would you say that it's possible that she gets it, but she doesn't agree with you? Well, no, that isn't possible. If she understood, like I'm explaining to her, she'd have to agree with me because what I'm saying is true. And that kind of notion of, of course I'm right, he could just say this to me in this group and I'm sitting there kind of chuckling at him, and he doesn't even get why I'm chuckling at him because he just thinks, of course, there's only one right answer. I've thought this through. There it is. If she's coming up with something else, it's because she doesn't have the right facts. So I used to always say, now, are you sure she doesn't understand, or is it that she doesn't stand under you? Which one is it? Now, and I'd always write this up in the board and go, what? But anyway, my point here is that this notion of entitlement is not visible to the person who holds it. It's almost invisible to them. And also the person who lives in that system of domination Most of us have been socialized to accept on some level that kind of power and control. And then once you get into that relationship and the person's telling you over and over, you're stupid, you're ugly, no one else will have you, and you've already been preconditioned as a woman to accept some of that stuff, then you've got this relationship of dominance and you've got this relationship of dependence. And so the struggle for her is to be able to develop a consciousness separate from all of the junk he's putting into her head and separate from all the junk that society has put into her head that he's feeding into. For her to get her mind free of him is as important as to get physically out of that relationship. And so it's a relationship not simply of physical dominance. It's a relationship of emotional and psychological dominance, but his dominance is buttressed by the society in which both she and he are socialized. So let me stop here and take comments from people. This is not just where you have to ask a question, but you can, give your own philosophy about whatever you want to say. And let's see, Stephanie, if some people... Now, can I just say, would somebody put their finger on there and press the button to get in line and say something? Because you don't want to sit and listen to me for a whole hour and a half.
At this time, if you do have a question, please press the number 1 on your phone at this time. Be sure to press the digit 1 only once. If you press it more than once, you will remove yourself from the question queue.
Are they just pouring in, Stephanie?
Okay, we do have a question from our caller in Utah. Your line is open.
Well, I guess that's me. I don't really have a question. I just wanted to say thank you for letting us have this opportunity, or myself have this opportunity, and I look forward to hearing more.
Okay, thank you very much.
And at this time, there are no additional callers in the queue, actually. We do now have a guest from Wisconsin. Your line is open.
Yes. Hi. This is Michelle in Madison. And regarding the five theories explaining battering that you went through, I'm just wondering if you've ever had an experience where you see sometimes multiple theories. And I know you had discussed that there are theories that can contradict each other, but are you seeing where there can be some commonalities, of course, too, within an individual you see who is battering?
Well, let me say this. First of all, you can easily have a batterer that fits what I'm saying and have the theory that I have of dominance, and that person also has a pathology.
Mm-hmm.
But that pathology plays out in the form of wife beating and a certain kind of attack of her as a woman, because he also holds those beliefs of a batterer, right? So, for example, you could have post-traumatic stress syndrome. You could have, but it wouldn't play out that you're going to attack your wife particularly unless you were in a society that already said she had to pay for any emotional harm that was coming to you. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
So they go together. The pathology plays out against her because you're living in a society that says she pays for your pain. I mean, that, you know, when I was doing men's groups, a lot of stress that men were under, like Lenore Walker's thing, if he's under a lot of stress, that's true. He would get fired. He would be put up with all this junk from work. He'd come home. He'd be under a lot of stress. Why would that stress get carried out towards her, except you also have this thing coming out of his entitlement to use her to dump on? So there's got to be – it wouldn't happen in a society where you didn't have her position – a lower position to him in the family unit, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, women are under a lot of stress, and yes, they might be mean to him, but they don't beat him up and they don't attack him and things like that, because that's not the way they've been socialized to think that he's the receptacle of that kind of stress. He is the receptacle. I mean, if the family isn't doing well, women might go after him because she's socialized to think you're supposed to take care of us financially and you're not. And the male is socialized to think I'm not supposed to be living in this kind of emotional pain or whatever, and you're going to pay for that. So you've got, in that way, you have sometimes a pathology going on with battering. You also have Walker's thing about stress is true, that when men get under a particular amount of stress but they have to also have a propensity to batter, because there's a lot of men living under a lot of stress that never beat up women over it, because they don't have this other element that they also get to use her to vent on. And they don't have this other kind of added. I do want to say that if you look at the men that were in my group, they had a tremendous amount of hostility towards women that would come out in times of stress and anger and et cetera. You know that I'm going to associate this again with the racist thoughts. You can see that for all you white people listening, that all of a sudden out of what seems to be nowhere, some kind of racist thought comes in. You'll see something on TV, or you'll watch something, you think, oh, for God's sakes. And out will come this kind of hostility towards this person as a Jewish person or as a black person. And I, when that happens to me, I think, oh, my God, where did that come from? And this was coming out all the time from men in my groups, is this hostility towards women, that was just like, you whore, you slut, all that kind of sexualization of her. And where does all that come from? It isn't his own individual kind of words coming out. He's socialized into that notion that ultimately, you know, the sexualization of women and also the making women dirty, the sexualization of women, and then that women ultimately will turn on you and use their sexual things against you. All that kind of stuff that gets mixed up in his head. And it comes out as he's hitting her and kicking her and beating her. He's saying all these things to her. Not necessarily out of something she did or behavior that she had, but all the stuff that's in his head as this is all coming out against her. So that doesn't come from a pathology. That comes from a socialization and blah, blah, blah. But there could be a pathology in there, too. Does that make sense?
Perfect sense.
Yeah. And I wanted to say something else about the Walker's theory about learned response to stress and anger, and many of you have used that kind of three-phase cycle. And if I might just take a second to say that why I think it's not a good theory for us to be using, and again, because I think it's the reason I think theory is important is because it points to decision makers about what's important to pay attention to. And Walker's theory says that the person is beating her up and battering her because of anger and stress. Well, what causes his anger? Oftentimes her behavior would be the natural thing to think. She pushes his buttons. She causes him stress. This causes him stress. So if you want the judge to think that way, then the judge thinks if he's away from her, then the source of his anger and his stress is gone. If he got a job, then the source of his stress is gone. But there's no indication that these things stop battering. There is an indication that when batterers are under stress, they batter more. They use more violence. But there isn't an indication that that stress, economic hardship, creates battering. And I want to say something else about this, is that in Lenore Walker's theory, you have this idea that I want to make this equation again to kind of anti-racism work, is that if you think about this, she's saying that tension builds and builds and builds, and then there's an explosion phase, and then this getting nice phase, and that then he brings her back into the fold during the getting nice phase, and then now he's caught her back again. She was just about ready to go away, and he brings her back in. Now, if you were to equate that to, would you ever get 15 little white racists who have all committed race crimes and put them in a little room and say, okay, now, can you imagine Martin Luther King saying, this is a learned response to stress and anger. Now, can you breathe in and breathe out? You know, what did you think when you saw that black man with a white man's job? Breathe in and breathe out. Well, what about when you saw that black man with a white woman? Breathe in and breathe out. And this is stress. Why is there such thing as a white man with a black man with a white man's job? Where did that thinking come from? Where did the thinking that a black man with a white woman was an affront to a white man in any way? That's all racialized thinking. And Martin Luther King, I think, wouldn't look at the stress and the anger. He would look at the racist thinking. And I think that's the problem when we started doing all these anger management groups for men and all these psychological theories. We got away from the idea, but there's this underlying thing of his thinking, his gender-based thinking about her and punishing her and retaliating. And just as you wouldn't psychologize necessarily white racist to this individual person saying this is a sickness that you have, you'd see it as him being socialized as a white person to go down this path. Now, we don't all go down that path, but you wouldn't erase the race in the crime and just focus on the stress. White person, can you get less stressed out? Can you get less angry? You focus on their racial consciousness. And so I think that's a major kind of problem in the whole field today, is that so many people want to ignore the gender base of this particular kind of behavior and go to things like stress or anger, dysfunction, or all of these kind of things. And it really begs the question of why the woman, why the family, why the kind of sexualized kinds of attacks, et cetera, et cetera. So the final theory points to, I think, a broader range of things. It makes gender visible. It makes power difference visible. It makes entitlement visible. And anger and all of those things then get explained within that. Because if you're living in a triangle and people at the top of the triangle, if people at the bottom of the triangle resist their authority, or if they fight back, or if they don't accept that authority, then the anger comes from that resistance. And so then she's going to pay for that resistance. It also explains a lot of women's violence, that people at the bottom of those triangles, they use violence back. Very few people just get beat up and banged on and whacked around without using violence back. But, you know, I used to play, and when I did my men's groups, I used to play tapes of these white South Africaners talking about black people's violence in South Africa and how they're out of control. And this is why we have to have one, we have to have the vote only for the white man, because he's in control. And the black man isn't in control. And this explanations for how in a system of apartheid, which is one of the most brutally violent systems, to say that the violence of people reacting was why you had to have the control in the first place and why you had to have apartheid was just exactly the kind of thinking that ultimately batterers get into. Look at her. She's nuts. She's crazy. She's this. She's that. I have to do these things. And so all of that kind of I'm the victim, which is very, very common in all people who dominate other people, is a sense of a burden by their own, you know, the whole white man's burden, the notion that we are suffering because of the people who we're dominating. And so that's why I like a theory that has historical in nature, and it's broader in that it takes in other forms of kind of group violence against other people, because we have to say we're dealing with group violence here. When we look at the amount of violence by men against women in this society, we have to say there's something to do with gender about all of this, even though there are many amongst us that want to take the gender out of it. But I think there's little bits in these other theories that have an element of truth, but what I do is, and I incorporate the part of the truth in them into the last theory, because I think the last theory points the finger at the right thing, which is the unequal status of men. If you look at societies around the world, the lower women's economic and social status to men, the more violence there is against them within marriage and publicly in other ways. So ultimately the solution to violence against women, we're working on kind of helping individual women cope with the violence and get out of it or rearrange the power relationships within their marriage. But at the same time, until you have real parity between men and women in society, real social and political and economic equality of power, women will always suffer more violence than men in private relationships. Any other people on, Stephanie?
Yes, ma'am. We do have a question from a caller in Tucson, Arizona. Your line is open.
Thanks. Hi, this is Vanessa calling from Tucson. And we were just wondering if there's any information or statistics or just, I guess, general information about if men providing services in counselor or in batterer intervention programs, if that makes any difference, if the response seems to be more positive from the male batterers in the group, or if there doesn't really seem to be any difference, and what your thoughts are about that.
Well, let me say this. Men who go into counseling for battering, there's a certain group of men that get pushed into counseling for battering because the courts push them in there, and they have absolutely no interest of being there, and they're not going to cooperate one iota. That's not the majority of them, but there's this kind of little group there that's going to either come and be disruptive, not show up at all, or just kind of, you know, not take anything in. But the men who are going there, even if they don't want to come, eventually most of the guys start talking and getting into things, and the relationship they have with the group leader is very important into how reflective they are willing to kind of become about themselves. So one of those things about that is gender. a lot of the men are going to have a hard time developing, you know, because the generally speaking, the men in these groups are on an average more hostile towards women than men generally in society. So for a woman facilitator to make a connection with these men is harder than for a male facilitator to.
Okay.
A lot of women can do it. I think here's a couple things. If these men tick you off, you can't be in there because they, you know, it's just like, you shouldn't have to. I want to say for all of you who have tried doing men's groups and they just made you so mad, it's not, you know, a failure of your spiritual development. It's not your work, you know. But on the other hand, I think that there's a funny kind of thing. I watch women do these groups and some women are just really mad at the men and they do it very punitively and they're very stiff with them. Other women are on the other end where they're just colluding like crazy with them. It's hard to kind of get in that middle zone where you can be very clear with them. And I found, for me personally, the way that, you know, eventually I did get to be a good group leader. I wasn't in the beginning because I was so judgmental of them. And I started to listen to them, really listen to them talking, and I thought, you know, I can hear myself in what they're saying. And as soon as I stopped seeing them as so completely different than I would ever be, once I started to think, you know, they, like me, have these kind of twisted thoughts. They, you know, they're on a different level. They're about different things. But I started to really see, and I started to see myself, I started to really having to struggle personally with my own issues. I mean, I think it really was the beginning of me becoming much less of a racist when I started working with the men, because I always was a liberal, but I started to understand my racism much better when I started doing, about 2 years into doing men's groups, because I just started to see what that notion of dominance is all about. And I used to say to the men all the time that you wanted the controller. And they kept saying, no, I didn't. And I finally listened to them and thought, you know what, they're not wanting the controller, they feel entitled to. And when I started to find these distinctions and realize that's what I was doing in a lot of my own relationships with my power dynamics with people of color was about the same kind of things, of feeling entitled to certain things. And so I think that when women give up their judgments of the men, because the men sense that very, very quickly, and if they can be there, and they can be there in a very powerful way with them, but without all of the, I would never do this, and you've harmed one of my sisters kind of attitude, it's hard to do because the men are so hostile in some ways to women, and they want to joke around about it. And if your male facilitator is clueless as to how to handle those things, then you're really stuck, because you not only have the 15 guys in your group doing it, or the 12 guys, but then your facilitator, you look over at him, and he doesn't really know how to handle the situation right. And so then you're just kind of stuck in a place of not being able to move in very constructive ways. So, but I do think women can be very, very good at this work, and I think there's a lot of challenges to us to do it. I think on men's side, they have the same kind of thing, is that men who go into men's groups and can't, if they either collude too much, you know, or they get into this thing of kind of puffing out their chest and pontificating with these guys, they too have to be self-reflective. And all you got to do is stay 4 steps ahead of the guys to be good. And it's
right.
Not that hard, really. You know, but it's really a thing of coming to grips with your own ego, your own self, your own judgments, and that's what makes a good facilitator.
Okay. Can I ask another question? I know that you work sort of under the theory of dominance model, but we're curious about the therapy model that is used with domestic violence men, or offenders, where you're coming from, if there's a particular therapy model that you utilize.
Well, you know, I'm an educator, not a therapist. I think a lot of therapists can have the same theory I have, that this comes from an entitlement thing, and then they use more of a therapeutic model with the person. To be a therapist doesn't mean that you have to individualize this to a pathology. a lot of people in the therapy world will go to a pathology model and say, this guy has this kind of pathology going on, and they won't look at it historically, socially, the way I am. A lot of therapists will. Now, the difference between an educator and a therapist is really how they work with the men. I work with the men in more of an educational mode, where I don't work with so much the individual in the group as this guy's talking, and I'll say, how many other men have the same thing going on? And then I'm asking them to have insights about that and what kind of things, what would you have to do differently right now, today? I don't necessarily work with the individual so much in expressing feelings and a lot of those kind of things. And so I think a therapist is going to work with a person a little bit more on an individual basis than someone like me is. But I don't think the difference is between a therapeutic and educational approach. If you have the same theory I'm talking about, you'll kind of be highlighting the same things as your belief systems, where you got these ideas about women, where that's leading, what that means about your capacity to love, what that means about your capacity to love your daughter, what that means about what you're going to teach your son. Those kinds of approaches to this kind of work with the men you could do as a therapist or as an educator.
Okay, thanks.
Liz, is this call over at 3:30 or 3:15?
3:30.
Oh, okay. That's kind of a good thing to know.
Yeah.
Are we done? Or?
Uh-huh.
Any other questions, Stephanie?
Yes, we do have another question from New Mexico. Your line is open.
Hi, Ellen. This is Jane Steeling in Taos, and I'm here with five of my colleagues at a Battered Women's Program.
Hi.
We had two questions. One is, well, the theory analysis is really helpful, and our experience is that the system really likes it to be gender neutral. And so we're sort of wondering how to talk about that with them, because they really resist the analysis of power and control and want to talk about how women have control in relationships vis-a-vis sexuality, particularly, and also that, you know, they think that they should be in charge of the parenting. And so if they see her as a bad mother, then she's a violator, you know, of what they think good womanhood is. So that was one kind of area that I was curious about. And then the other is, I was wondering if you would speak to same-sex battering at all. And when you take the gender analysis out of that, how do you talk about this in this work?
Right. Okay. Well, let me say a couple things about, first of all, let me just talk about the parenting issue, et cetera, in here. I'm just going to say a couple things about that, and it's a little bit beyond what you're asking, but I'll get back to also the questions you're asking. If people are living together and one person is battering the other and children are living with them, children, let me just say this, children are not witnessing this violence, nor are they observers of the violence. They are drawn into the violence always. They're drawn into the dynamic of power and the dynamic of control in that relationship. And they're drawn, because children don't live outside of their relationships with their parents. They live inside their relationship with their parents. It's like you're living in that house, therefore you're living inside that relationship. And so the ways that children become a part of that violence and a part of that, both the domination and the resistance, is something that people who work with batterers and battered women have to be tuned into and have to be aware of, because the children, first of all, they have their own independent relationships, both with their fathers and their mothers. The courts tend to think that, for example, if the child goes off with the mother and then doesn't want to visit the father, the courts will think, oh, that the mother's not letting him visit the kids, that she's poisoning his mind. And vice versa, too, if the father has him and she doesn't want to visit the children. When children separate from a parent, let's just say in this case the father has left the home and he battered the woman, and now you've got four children here. Each of those children are going to have a reaction to him leaving, and they're going to have different responses to the extent to which they want to see him and have a relationship with him. And that's going to be based on their previous relationship with him. It's based on where he goes. Like, let's say this guy leaves her, and he has used violence against her. just the fact that he's used violence against their mother is going to be an alienating factor between the child and the father. It's not going to be overriding necessarily, but for some of them it's going to be, I don't want to see you because of what you did to mom, and some of you it's going to be, why did you do that to mom? But the other part is that the parent is going to go, and if he lives in this little apartment all by himself, children are going to be more likely to want to visit him. If he moves in with another woman, children are going to be less likely to want to visit him. If he moves in with another woman with children, children are going to be far less likely to want to go visit him and have more resentments towards him. So each step away from them, each step that means that he's leaving them, not just the mother. Children don't always see it as, oh, he's leaving my mother, he's leaving me. But some children wanted that to happen. They were afraid of him. They wanted him out of the house. And so the fact that he left, they're not wanting him to come back. In fact, they might even like him more now that he's out of the house. So the first thing I want to say is that the courts oftentimes see the children only as being pawns of each parent and children's reaction as being a reaction to each parent, when in fact children's reactions to their parents are based on their own relationships with those parents, their own identities, their own psychological makeup, their own, you know, they have their own relationships with people. Too often we see children, we objectify children to the fact that we only see them in the courtroom as the possession of which parent is going to end up with them. And we don't see them as their own entities that have independent relationships with those two parents. So that's a whole other kind of big, long spiel. But the place it plays out that you were speaking to is that if the woman goes off with another man, oftentimes she's seen as abandoning her kids more, because if she's going off with another man, she's going off with someone, number one, that she's going to give attention to, but also that she's introducing into those kids' lives a man that may be not stable, may be dangerous, may be this or may be that. If a man goes off with another woman, that's actually seen positively in the divorce court because he's going off with someone who can care for those children. So if he's got a good job, and he's got a house, and he can bring those kids to a stable house with a woman in it, that's seen much more positively than if she does the same thing. So there's all sorts of ways that sexism plays out in the court system around custody and access. It plays out against men in that there's a fairly big factor in the court system is who has been taking care of the children. That's who the children, stability-wise, would want to stay with. And, of course, that's typically going to be the mother because of the way sex roles are in our society. So he loses out as the breadwinner out there in the workforce kind of person in that category of who's been taking care of and caring for those children in a way that's kind of got a gender bias whole twist to it. So there's tons of, like, gender kind of stuff that goes on in that a divorce court that's, everything's got a kind of a gender overlay to it, but it's supposedly trying to be played out as a gender-neutral kind of process. And another thing is just children's bonds with their mothers, I can't say this across the board universally, but that whole bond with the mother, especially if the mother's been playing the kind of traditional role of mother. I mean, we live in a society where women's role as mothers is very clearly to pay attention to, be with, and pay attention to the emotional and constant needs of children. And so you can't compare the relationship of both children to the fathering and mothering in our culture are two very different things. Whoever's been doing the mothering, whether it's a man or a woman, has been doing a very big function with children that separating from that them from that is very, very disruptive to their lives. And so there's tons of gender stuff in that family court that, like you say, everyone wants to act like we're a gender-neutral society, but we aren't. This society plays out very, very strongly around gender roles, around race roles. And so whenever we try to make like we're colorblind or genderblind, it just doesn't work because it's not the kind of society we live in. And I forgot what your other question was. I don't even know if that answered one of them.
was that you had talked earlier about men having, first of all, thank you for using the word sexism, because it just doesn't ever get used anymore. But here particularly, I think gender roles are so incredibly ingrained, and our system, capital S system, the courts, the police, whomever's responding, aren't willing to say that women don't have any power in this relationship, because they see their sexuality as the ultimate weapon that women wield in this relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And it just makes it very complicated to be able to talk with them about the whole system of power and control when they're not willing to acknowledge that there is any kind of gender bias. So that was one, that was kind of that whole thing that we were just talking about. The other was to talk about same-sex relationships.
Right, okay. Well, let me do the same-sex relationship thing first, and that is to say that, the reason in heterosexual relationships that you have, you've got this whole kind of historical notion of men having authority in their family over women and children. And that has played out for thousands of years in Western history, and in many other kind of cultures besides European Western culture. It's played out in many, many cultures. So we carry that with us culturally now, this notion of men being in control in the family. But that control comes from the basic notion of ownership. And that it comes from the historical notion that men owned women in relationships. And that became partly that the way that you became the partner of an ownership was when people started to have sex together. So in gay relationships, the notion of ownership is still there very strongly, because people have been, some people think that gay people are socialized. Gay people are socialized as heterosexuals in a funny kind of way, right? So the idea that some people have is that it would play out that you have butch-femme kind of relationships, and the butch is battering the femme. That's not really proving to be very true when you look at that in gay relationships. There's kind of a little saying that people say, it's butch on the streets, femme in the sheets. So you can't even tell really by people's representation of butch or femme whether or not they actually play out that in the intimate relationship with a person. But what you do have still is the notion that people come into that relationship with ownership. Once I've slept with you, you're mine. And when someone brings that into a relationship with two men or two women, that notion of ownership, I've slept with you, now you're mine, they're going to bring with that the entitlements that come with that. So, and I think that it can run a little bit along kind of traditional lines of who might be representing kind of the more male or female part, but that's not, from what I understand. Now, I have to say, I've not worked in this area a lot. I did a few, when we did groups in Duluth, we never had enough gay men or women to be in the group to do groups, so we always end up working with people individually, and you don't really learn as much by doing that in terms of what's going on generally. But I can say specifically it didn't play out very consistently from people that I worked with, that butch and femme was much of a good reader of who was going to be the batterer, who's going to be the victim. I did find it very strange in that people who had a lot of experience working with batterers couldn't figure out who was the victim and who was the batterer in gay relationships. Like, the only way to find out was, who's the male and who's the female. There's so many things that we know about what batterers do. When I started seeing people trying to get people fired, trying to attack people, things like that, I usually thought, I think that's who the batterer is. Because I never saw a lot of heterosexual women come into my office trying to get her batterer fired, just the opposite. And so it was strange to me that in lesbian cases particularly, the dynamics that went on weren't fairly easy for people to see. This is the person who's trying to harm the other person. This is the person who's going after them. This is the person who's, on the attack kind of thing. And this is the person who's claiming, as they're on the attack, the victim status. So I find it more frustrating that people with a lot of experience in domestic violence couldn't use their knowledge of the dynamics of battering and the way that people punish and stuff as batterers, couldn't use that knowledge to identify who the abuser was, and found themselves very confused all the time, particularly in lesbian cases.
Thank you.
So we're at about 3:28. Are there any other questions, Stephanie?
Not at this time.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you. Well, this is very good. People kind of got in there and asked a lot of questions, which always, I think, makes it more interesting to people. And tomorrow we'll be back here, and we're going to be talking tomorrow about a little bit different types of violence, but we'll be going on a little bit more in this thing. We're also going to play a tape for you, and I'll use the handouts from today in tomorrow's thing. So otherwise Liz will yell at me for sending all these handouts out and not using them. But Liz, I want to thank you very much for getting us all together and remind everybody that Liz always tells me to remind you that the thoughts and ideas expressed on this call were paid for by OVW but not necessarily shared by OVW, and that these are kind of the ramblings of myself, and I'm not necessarily expressing all these things for the OVW office, but they do want people to be able to come together for these kind of sessions, think together, talk together, learn together, and for you to use this in whatever way is useful to you. Tomorrow we'll talk a lot more about the different kinds of violence, and then I thought we'd talk a little bit about the rage right now, which is the Chris Brown story. So if you tune in tonight on any talk show, you'll hear something about Chris Brown, and this is kind of the new domestic violence story that's out there. But I want people to pay attention today, if they can, to any, if you go Google or anything, look at what people are saying about this case, and this will be kind of a good follow-up to our discussion today about theories of violence, because everyone who's commenting on it is commenting from a theory. By the way, we will also go back to Jason's story tomorrow, and I'll do a little evaluation for you on the way people voted, okay? So thank you very much for coming. We'll see you again tomorrow. And what time tomorrow? At the same time, huh, Liz?
Same time tomorrow, yep, 2 o'clock
okay.
Central.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Ellen. Thanks to everybody for participating today. And don't forget, we're always interested in your feedback, so be sure to send your evaluation to me. Thanks, everybody. Take care. Talk to you tomorrow.